Welcome to Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. I'm Carolyn Freeman, and today I am chatting with Tom Vazda about AI and the future of cybersecurity. Tom is an AI and cybersecurity strategist, the CEO at Riscoria, a certified AI and cybersecurity expert, and a keynote speaker. Welcome, Tom. I'm so delighted to have you on board.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Tom, before we get chatting about the work you do, and can you tell me a little bit more about who you are, what you do, and what the pivot point was that sent you down the road of kind of AI and cybersecurity?
Well, absolutely, Carolyn. Well, first, my journey into AI and cybersecurity wasn't really a straight line, but it was driven by persistent fascination, you know, with how people interact with systems and how these systems in turn, you know, how they shape our behavior. And I worked across enterprise risk because I worked also as a chief security officer for a bank. I worked in cybersecurity, AI development for many years. But what pulled me in was actually the human layer. And we know that technology, it changes really fast, but our cognitive wiring, it doesn't. And that's the space that I actually live in, you know, helping organizations to understand both the technical and also psychological vulnerabilities that they face. And then working in Riscoria, which is my company, it gave me actually a platform to shape the strategy, you know, for compliance. And I basically work globally here. And we work in AI, using a responsible AI, and also at the same time, staying resilient against all the emerging threats.
And we're going to talk about that a little bit more, but I originally asked you to come on the podcast as you've recently been posting on LinkedIn about our phones listening to our conversations. And I'd love to start chatting to you about that, plus the Romaine Scans post that you've done. And I've often marveled at the adverts that come on social media feeds, and they seem to directly reflect conversations I've had recently with someone. And I've often actually said my phone is flipping listening to what I say, and almost feel slightly violated by the whole process of being listened to. And this is despite having heard so many times about it's all about the algorithms. And my logic, just as I see those ads, still flips into my phone is listening to me. And so my question is, what's really going on with kind of the algorithms and the adverts that seem to indicate that our phones are listening to us?
Well, it's a common experience. And it really does feel uncanny, but like your phone must be eavesdropping. But in most cases, it's not actually about active listening. It's about this correlation and the behavioral prediction at some granular level. And algorithms, they can track our digital breadcrumbs, you know, like your search history, your geolocation, the way you use your application on your phone, even how long you pause on a post. And with all this information, algorithms, they can build really incredible, accurate profiles. And that's actually how platforms can serve ads that feel like really timely. And that's why they have this impression that somebody is listening. But you're actually absolutely right to feel a little bit violated. And the real issue is not actually the device. No, it's actually the systems behind your device. Now, the business models that profit from surveillance level data collection, you know, without enough scrutiny or without enough user control, they're what we should be actually challenging here.
Do you think also in some ways it's like, because I know there's a bias that I can't remember the name of, but if I'm looking or in the market now to buy a mini car, for example, I suddenly start seeing a lot of mini cars around. Do you think it's a similar thing in that if you've recently had a conversation about something, that you're more aware of it and therefore more likely to pay attention to the ad that comes up? So maybe therefore think that it's been listening as well.
Well, exactly. Yes. Well, when people say, you know, my phone is listening, and I actually have the same experience because I recently purchased a new car. And when I was looking for a car, suddenly there were different car ads, different dealerships. And I was like, somebody listening to me. So actually, I was personally intrigued to investigate a little bit more here. So when people say, you know, my phone is listening, they're actually pointing to some real problem here, not only with the right target. Phones that we have, they're just the interface. And the real power lies in the systems that are running behind them, you know, the platforms that own your data, the brokers that package and sell this data, and also machine learning models that are trained on your behaviors. And these are not only some passive tools, you know, they're actually engines of influence. And because they're invisible, you know, and they're visible to most users, we are not even aware they exist. You know, they escape the kind of accountability that we would demand from other institutions with the level of reach into our private lives.
Do you think there is quite a bit of regulation already in place, or do you think we need more regulation on this specifically?
Well, that's a wonderful question about regulations, because, you know, in Europe, I think we have regulation for everything, and we're probably overly regulated. And when you're overly regulated, then you have a problem. How do you actually, what is applicable, what is not? So I believe there is enough regulation for everything, but it's actually how is this regulation enforced? And also public awareness. The people need to understand that there is no free lunch. So basically, if you're using free applications, like large social media companies and stuff, they're free. They're not really free because you become the product. And all the data, the way you type, the way you write, whatever you do with a phone, this is all valuable data about your emotional state, data about your chat history, you know, everything is a product, basically. You are the product.
And as you say, like we sign up to those terms of additions and we actually agree to it, and then we get offended when they use the stuff that we've agreed to.
And the thing is, you know, we agree to something without even reading, because usually you get terms and conditions and everything pretty long list, small print. So what do? You want to read this, or you just want to accept? You want to accept because you want to use the application. And then basically you surrender your life to somebody else.
We had a bit of a mini discussion around the phrase that's often used, my phone is listening to me. And because reality is, it's, as you were saying before, it's not the metal and plastic that has agency and kind of sentience to enough to listen to our conversations. It's kind of the systems behind it that deserve our scrutiny and kind of accountability. And can you talk a bit more about that and what your thoughts are around the way that we see our phones, the actual device, rather than the background stuff that's going on?
Well, the thing is, with phones, what we see right now, we see each other on screen, but I have no idea about, you know, how do you look in real life? You see the what you want to see of me, but sometimes it's your imagination. Actually, many times this is how people fall for scams, because they think they're talking to somebody who is real, but it's actually a reflection of our mind. And this is where the real problems actually start. And this is where people fall for scams by using technology. And this is the modern disease that we are still trying to figure out how to fight against.
That segues really nicely into the next question I have about romance scams, which you've been posting quite a lot about recently. And you talk about a two-layer model of romance scams and the emotion and manipulation that kind of builds from that initial conversation. What are those two layers, and how are people targeted through their vulnerabilities in these scams?
Well, I'm happy to answer, and I'm glad I actually asked this question, because I don't think there is enough awareness about romance scams. Because by itself, when you say romance scam, the first thing would be like, who would fall for that? Why would people fall for that? But it's actually more serious. It's actually psychological operations with our mind. And I have some personal experience also about this. You know, so actually, I was actually personally involved to start raising awareness how this works. So we actually spread the word. We talk about this. It's not only about losing money. It's actually losing your mind. So basically, there are two layers of how this works. Well, first, there is the surface layer. And the surface layer is the narrative. And this is where emotional hooks are planted. And all these emotional hooks are like love, loneliness, some shared values with somebody who's on the other side. And scammers, they mirror their target's language and their emotional needs just to build trust first. But the deeper layer is actually in this behavioral conditioning. And over time, victims aren't just being manipulated emotionally. You know, they're being trained to respond to rewards, and these rewards are from the scammer. Rewards are affection. You get their attention, but there are also threats like withdrawal, like guilt, And it becomes a form of self-coercive control. And this is why we see all these scams escalate from simple financial fraud into something that is far more complex. And this is basically abuse. It's identity theft. It could be money laundering. Even making somebody to participate in some criminal network. And this is actually where the real problem begins, because people usually see the surface. Somebody fell in love with somebody over the internet. This is what I see, and this could never happen to me. And this is the belief. But it's actually a very, very serious issue, and I think in the future we'll have even more situations like this, especially now with the rise of AI, which augments scammers. And we also need to understand that on the other side, it's not one person. It's a criminal organization, or even worse than that. That's why I want to talk about this issue.
How do you think then AI will be involved in that? Do you think that they would be able to train AI in terms of you as a single person and how to manipulate you better based on your social media feeds or other things you put online? Or how do you think they'll use AI to exploit someone?
Well, with AI, it's actually about deepfakes. So basically, somebody can impersonate your voice in real time, your persona, just to present themselves. You know, right now, you already have really available tools where you can talk to somebody. You see me, but it's not me. It's somebody else talking. And the scary part is this is already freely available. And it's being used. And since last year, I believe it was February of last year, it was actually the first known financial attack from Hong Kong to a bank in UK, where they, I don't know how many millions, actually 20 million pounds were stolen, only because the person who was talking from Hong Kong to his peers in the UK with four people, they're all fake personas. They're digital personas, you know, AI-made personas. And the person in Hong Kong just initiated the transfer of money. But by the time they realized the following morning what happened, it was already too late. And this was just the very beginning of some sophisticated crime. Now, with the development of AI, everything is moving so fast. And basically, each week, there is some new development. So when we talk about AI and scammers together, it's very, very scary world, what's happening and what's coming next. Because I don't think we're ready as humans. We are completely unprepared. We are vulnerable. And I don't know, is awareness enough? I don't think so. Because the thing is, even the governments are not ready. They need to be ready. You know, we can have the best regulations, the best tools in the world, but people are not ready yet, you know, and this is developing so fast. It's really difficult to keep track of all the developments and on the new new attack vectors also.
With software companies, with this whole race towards AI dominance, software companies are, or AI companies are, upgrading their systems so quickly and what they have available that it seems as though there's no way that even as individuals or as companies or governments that we can actually keep up with what they're doing or what they can do.
Yes, well, here we come actually into discussion about ethical use of AI and how do we do that. You know, in EU, there is EU AI Act. This is like the very first regulation in the world regulating AI. It's basically insisting on risk-based approach on how do we decide which systems are the systems to be used to process data, to process our personal data, to train with the personal data. And the next step is actually, you know, deciding which systems can go, can be implemented with companies, which cannot. But ethical frameworks are the key. Actually, how are these systems going to be used and how are they going to use the data here? And in countries that don't have ethical regulations, you know, it's a free world. they can do whatever they want. There are nothing to stop them from using this against other countries. That's why it's really scary. And that's why we see now this race in AI between China, US, EU, you know, so it's really interesting how this is going to develop in the following months. I don't even want to say years. It's about in the following months, because it's moving so fast.
Do you think also there's an element of dark web AI that we're not really familiar with? I've got no idea what's going on in the real kind of the non-dark web world that could really impact us in the non-dark web.
Absolutely, because criminals, they're, or rogue states, they're always one step ahead of us. And AI is being used now for many years. As I said, you know, on the good side, you know, we have to defend, I guess, something that you're not even aware it exists, but you need to think like a criminal. But the thing is, AI is already used. You know, there's like fraud, GPT, applications like that. There are different types of applications that are used actually to impersonate people, to impersonate emails for phishing. Even adaptive malware is written with AI, something that can adapt itself to the current vulnerabilities and just scans networks and attacks. So it's not even the future anymore. It's happening.
It's in real time. It's kind of real time updates.
In real time, yes.
Yeah. So what do people need to account for so they can reduce the risk of being scammed? And how do you think the cyber world needs to respond to these threats kind of going forward on a day-to-day basis, really?
Well, AI, it can actually supercharge some traditional threats that we have just discussed. And phishing, it becomes hyper-personalized. And I talked about deepfakes, and deepfakes, they make it really hard to verify identities. Even though there are ways how you can identify identities now with deepfakes, but this is, we're so early in this process that the technologies are right now being developed. I mentioned this autonomous malware, you know, that can adapt in real time. And on the broader scale, generative AI can also replicate trusted voices. You know, it can forge documents, it can mimic biometrics, also your biometric data like your fingerprint or your eye, retina. And the biggest risk is not just more attacks, it's actually the erosion of trust. And if people cannot tell what's real online, you know, like the very foundation of this digital interaction really starts to break down. So this is the question of trust. This is the biggest issue here.
Yeah, that's a great word you've used in terms of trust, because I've been chatting to a few people recently about generative AI and the level of trust that it erodes. And we're talking really about emails and AI responding to emails and the level of trust that you then have with that communication with that person in terms of, is it them talking to me in an email or is it the AI talking back to me? And there seems to be a common word being used when it comes to AI is just the whole thing of erosion of trust. Do you think that that's really where we're going, is just not really trusting technology so much anymore?
That's a tough question. I do want to trust technology, but it's actually how this technology is being governed. That's the main issue. And again, you know, it's about regulations that we have already discussed. There is a way how to govern everything. There are international standards and regulations, you know, how to govern AI also. Most organizations, they don't even have the inventory of the tools they use, of their AI tools, cybersecurity tools, you know, and let alone to understand the risks around all this technology they have. And you really need the governance in place, you know, like how are you going to audit your system, you know, your usage policies, your clear accountability here. It's really important. That's for organizations, but for individuals like us, you know, it's about practicing digital skepticism. And skepticism, this is actually learning to recognize when something feels off and also knowing how to verify sources. This is something actually that we teach in my other jobs, that we teach students. It's actually critical thinking and problem solving. Because I really believe that this is the key question that younger generation, not even younger generations, people don't know how to critically think. We want to believe because everything sounds so good and you want to believe. And this is big problem here because you're just happy to click, happy to believe everything, whatever somebody tells you. That's why we have so many issues now with fake news, because people believe they're easy to manipulate. And long term, we also need public education on AI literacy. It's not only cybersecurity, it's AI literacy also. And just like we taught people, you know, how to spot spam emails, you know, we now need to teach them how to spot if there is like AI generated fraud. But this is something that's really difficult. You know, people don't even know how to use AI. They heard it's cool, or maybe they're afraid of it. And now we have to teach them how to recognize AI fraud, which is really next level.
I want to chat now about the psychology of cybersecurity. And you had a LinkedIn post titled Understanding Human Behavior to Enhance Cybersecurity, where you explain about how cognitive biases, emotions, and behavior, as well as kind of insider threats and external attackers who exploit, those people exploit our human vulnerabilities through social engineering, and how these things can impact cybersecurity as much as the technical defenses companies put in place. And can you talk a bit more about this and what companies need to think about from a human behavior and psychology perspective when thinking about or considering cybersecurity?
Yes, that's actually a good question about technical defenses. And technical defenses, you know, they're only as strong as the people they're using them. And we are actually wired to trust authority. We follow some social cues. We sometimes cut corners when we are overwhelmed. You know, these are all traits that attackers exploit daily. And social engineering attacks like phishing, they work not because the tech is weak. They work because our cognitive biases are predictable. And companies, they need to go actually beyond some awareness training, because awareness itself is not enough. Now, companies should actually integrate some behavioral insights into their cybersecurity strategies. And what does it mean? It means that they need to simulate some stress scenarios with their employees. They should test for some emotional manipulation tactics. But the thing is, how would you do that, you know? And they also need to understand, you know, how their internal culture influences risk-taking, because this is actually something that I have researched for my PhD, is actually a cybersecurity culture of companies. And this is whole new level, actually, of behavioral cybersecurity. Now, how do you actually measure cybersecurity culture, and how do you find inside threat? And this is actually very, very much focused on, because in every company, there is at least like 0.5% up to 1% of employees are actually those malicious employees. They want to do internal harm to their company. And how do you detect them? How do you find them? You know, this is something that's actually where I'm focused on, because cybersecurity culture, it's part of the overall culture of a company. It's of the overall corporate culture. It has its mission and vision and values and everything. And then the next part is actually, how do we deal with security in our company? This is where actually cybersecurity culture kicks in. So cybersecurity is as much a psychological field as it's also a technical.
So you say that companies need to not only have a technical side of cybersecurity, like don't pick up an external drive and put it into your computer. If you found it in the car park, it's possibly someone's placed it there in order to get some malware into the system. But it's all those other things that are emotional drivers and making people aware of what attackers can do from an emotional, cognitive, behavioral perspective.
That's true. Because we're only humans, you know, we as humans, we are vulnerable, we make mistakes also. And companies, you know, they need to have clear governance model, and they need to find actually which groups in every organization need special training, special attention, because not everybody has the same access to data. And as we said earlier today, that data is the most valuable thing for a company, most valuable thing for us as individuals. And that's why we voluntarily surrender our data without understanding about all the risks that are coming from surrendering data. So companies, they think, or they should think, mature companies, they should think the same way. How do we protect data? By protecting our employees, by teaching our employees actually how to behave properly in our environment that is completely digitalized, and their threats. There are threats that need to be resolved. So it's actually finding the right groups of people that need special training. So usually these are people who work in information technology, people who work in HR, people who are exposed to some trade secrets. They'll need some customized type of training that is relevant for them, but that is also not only like compliance training where you watch some presentations. It's actually, it should be something interactive, somewhere where you raise awareness by making it like use gamification maybe or something like that people get actually engaged with this, because each person who is on the first line of defense becomes basically the ambassador in a company who is promoting the idea of the safe organization, of the secure organization.
In your experience, what kind of percentage of companies do training in the kind of human behavior side of cybersecurity versus those who just focus on the basic technical side of cybersecurity?
Well, I can't really talk about percentages because I don't have this information. But I know that many companies are actually now moving into this psychological part because they realize having technology only is not enough. Because technology, in spite of how good it is, it's not going to solve the human problem. And the human problem is somebody who is actually taking images of their screens, people who are talking about trade secrets in outside of the company. You know, this is something that needs to be resolved actually with targeted trainings, not by threatening people with penalties or something, but actually by educating them that they're part of the corporation. You know, they're the ones who are the first line of defense, teaching them, you know, what is good, what is wrong, you know, but using common sense. And not by telling them something, but actually having them engaged in this conversation and being part of the solution, not looking at employees as being a threat. You know, they're not a threat. I believe every person that works for a company is a reasonable person. Otherwise, the person wouldn't be working for a company. But every company has its own policies, and it's important actually that these policies do get enforced. And they can get enforced only if you get people on your own side. But as I said, there is always like that really small, tiny percentage of people who are malicious, and they're malicious for different reasons. They have, I don't know, maybe they're gambling, maybe they didn't get promoted, so they're disgruntled employees. You know, there are different reasons why people would actually be working against the company. Maybe some people are there in debt, they want to sell some trade secrets, you know, these things all happen. They happen all the time. But if you're in charge of security of a company, you know, you need to know actually ways how to find them. So technology is just one layer of defense. There's actually that human layer, psychology. This is actually what's going to help you actually to understand who people are, what they are. But then again, you cannot do this by yourself. You need allies inside a company, or usually it's like human resources, people like that, you know, who actually work with people, and they can help you actually propagate the right message, you know, get the right message to the people that need to hear the message. So there are different ways how you can get to them. Yeah.
And then so companies and individuals going forward, it's just, as you said before, it's about just trying to keep up to date and having that human understanding, the human behavior side of how you can be threatened and then what to do about it and how to try and you used the word, it wasn't digital literacy, but it was digital skepticism.
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting way to say it. I haven't thought about it from that perspective of just being skeptical of everything that you come across, even if you think it's not deepfake.
See, I'm a security guy. By saying security guy, I got certified as CISSP back in 2004. And, you know, in years, I learned actually not to trust anyone, but not being paranoid, but not to trust everything that I see or that people tell me, because actually I want to believe that I understand the big picture and I can tell if somebody is being honest or dishonest. So that's why I'm saying this skepticism is like you take everything with a grain of salt. Because whatever people tell you, there is something a little bit more that can completely change the context. And if you work in security, it's really important to understand the context. And that's why this is called like also called contextual security, because you need to see all layers of security, not only what somebody tells you. You need more evidence, you know, more. Otherwise, you can make like really false assumptions. And then that's not cool. If you make false assumptions and accuse somebody of something, you need to have all the facts, all the evidence before you can actually go to the next step in investigation, and then you move on with this. Yeah, you know, that's why I'm saying digital skepticism, because everything is digitized. In cybersecurity, you do digital forensics. You know, so that's why you also need digital skepticism about everything you hear or see.
I like that, digital forensics. And I'd like to talk about your company, Riscoria. hopefully I pronounced it correctly. You're based in Croatia, but you operate globally. And one of the things you mentioned briefly is that 1 or 2% of employees who are kind of a bit malicious, and that's something that you help companies understand. What, outside of that, what does your company do and why do companies work with you?
Well, Riskoria is actually, the name says it all. It's Riskoria. So it's actually from risk euphoria. So I wanted to, a couple of years ago, I wanted actually to make my own company. And I'm glad about the decision, because this is definitely something that companies need. Usually you have like big four companies, you know, large companies, and I worked for them also before. And I know they can be also expensive, and they're definitely out of reach for small businesses. So I'm very much focused to SMEs, small, medium-sized businesses, globally, basically. And to use that knowledge that I have also from the banking industry and also from consulting, you know, how can we help small businesses? Because I don't know if you're familiar, but 90% of the economy, both European or American economy, is small to medium-sized businesses, SMEs. And they cannot afford all these expensive consultants, you know, getting all the knowledge. And they're actually very vulnerable. And now we're talking here about technologies like AI going, replacing business processes. You know, people are not even aware of all the threats that exist. And only if you're talking about AI threats, risks, you know, there are like more than 850 risks only by if you implement AI to your company. And everybody wants to do something fast. But if you do something fast, then it's game over. You cannot do this really fast. You need to understand actually what are the threats, how much is it going to cost, which resources I need, internal, external resources. You know, do I have strategy? Do I have the proper risk assessment? How am I going to govern this? So these are all the questions that I help actually companies answer before they actually go to the next step. And the next step is, what is the use case for AI? They all know there is something about AI. They heard people are doing it, companies are doing it, you know, but they're like, how do we find what is the best use case? This is also something where I focused on, and I help companies actually develop their strategy and find their pain points. Usually, I have actually a couple of clients that I helped develop this, the strategy and finding actual use cases. And they actually made some significant savings just by moving people to some more strategic jobs instead of doing some manual, you know, things that a script with some intelligence could do. But finding that, this is actually a key. And not only finding, but also securing. So that's why I'm seeing, you know, both cybersecurity and AI going hand by hand. Because you cannot implement AI without understanding cybersecurity, and you cannot do cybersecurity anymore if you don't have AI. So basically, this is like intersection of both fields, and I like both areas. You know, I actually enjoy what I'm doing, so I'm pretty happy with the way the business is going. And I know not only because of regulations that we talked about, but it's actually the question of being competitive on the market. You know, if you have AI, you'll make faster decisions, you'll move faster, you'll grow faster as a company, you'll have more time. But these are all the benefits. But with benefits, there also come threats. And we need to understand, what are the threats? Can we mitigate this risk of threats? And what can we do about it? So this is what I'm doing, helping companies. Yeah.
And then that's all overlapped by human factors and how human factors interlace between those two.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is all with human factor, because nothing happens without people, and people are key. And there is always a question, you know, is AI going to replace people? It's not going to replace people. It's actually going to augment people. It's going to make people work faster, more strategic jobs. Maybe, you know, there will be new types of jobs are already being created. And people, this is all part of some industrial revolution. So people need to move to different jobs. You know, why would you sit 8 hours a day in front of your screen and just type in something that's really boring, you know, without using your brain? Well, definitely this is something that we can replace with AI, by putting AI in the business process. So basically putting intelligence in your business process, and people who are doing that, they can, I don't know, they can monitor 10 systems like that. and they can orchestrate the systems, you know. So it's something that would be actually more fun, more entertaining. But definitely, you know, this is opportunity for everybody to learn something new, because you never stop learning. And if you're afraid of learning, then, well, you're already behind. Technology will push you. Unfortunately, this is the part how businesses work. You know, there is always new technology that's changing. The AI is a game changer, basically.
And it's compounding growth, constantly compounding growth in terms of our ability to do things and how quickly things get done. And as you said, if you don't integrate AI into your business processes, you're going to get left behind. And if you as an employee don't embrace it, you also going to get left behind.
Absolutely. And large companies are already doing it. You know, financial institutions, hospital systems, they're all looking into AI, because they're not only AI, it's also robotics. You know, it's integration of robotics and AI and data all together. You know, this is really powerful. And small companies, they need to do the same thing, but on a smaller scale for less money, but they need to replicate what larger companies are doing. As I said, you know, 90% of companies, small economy is small companies. And they need all the same technology, the same knowledge, and that needs to be affordable for them.
Yeah. Otherwise, they get left behind, really.
Absolutely, yes.
And you're also a keynote speaker and do a lot of travel doing presentations to companies and at conferences. What are the things you normally talk about? And if someone was wanting to engage as a speaker, what topics would you be able to focus on? And also, how can they get in touch with you?
Okay, so I usually speak on three different themes, and they're interconnected. So it's AI risk and resilience, it's human behavior in cybersecurity, and it's also digital crisis response. And I tailor all these talks based on the audience, you know, so whether it's, I don't know, like executive leadership, like technical teams, or even NGOs. I also work a lot with different types of NGOs. So it's all tailored experience. And also, I run simulations for like ransomware response. And also, I deliver also some briefings on emerging threats, especially the threats that are on the intersection of cybercrime and some psychological manipulation. This has been like for the past year very much in my focus, because I really see here a big problem with PsyOps. And anyone who is interested can reach out either via LinkedIn or my company webpage, which is riskoria.eu.
And then you also work a bit at the Open Institute of Technology. What is this institution? What does it teach? And how can someone apply to become part of it?
Well, OPIT, or Openness to Technology, that's also a project I'm really proud of. I serve there as area chair for cybersecurity. And I lead and I have developed this master's program in enterprise cybersecurity. So this is something that is happening fully online. It's a globally accessible program that combines also academic rigor with some real world relevance. And we are not only teaching some security fundamentals, we're actually preparing professionals to lead in space for AI, regulation, human factors, you know, where all collide together. And of course, there are other master's programs, but I'm the one responsible for enterprise cybersecurity. So basically, it's about creating cybersecurity leaders who understand, you know, both the systems and also the psychology behind the systems. I have developed also a couple of courses. One of the courses is behavioral cybersecurity. I believe I mentioned that before. And this is actually super interesting. We have just completed our second term now with the first generation who listened to this. And it was an interesting experience for our students. I'm happy for that. I'm looking forward actually to enhance the program now a little bit more. But honestly, you know, with the pace of change that we're seeing, you know, that kind of integrated thinking that we teach is something that is what the future needs.
Tom, we're coming to the end of our chat. And one of the questions I ask near the end of all my guests is, what is the most important question I haven't asked you yet?
I would like to say, you know, how do we build, you know, some psychological resilience in digital age, you know? So we're teaching people, you know, how to use these tools, you know, but we're not really teaching them how to survive emotionally in some environments that are engineered for manipulation. And cybersecurity, you know, it's not something that's only about defense. It's actually about self-awareness about boundary setting and also protecting our cognitive space. And I really believe, once again, you know, that I see big threat from integration of cybersecurity and psychological operations. So definitely, you know, how do we build this resilience against psychological operations? I don't have the answer, but I know there are many books written about this, you know, but the thing is, you know, how do we teach people that, you know, how do they become resilient? Well, definitely a podcast that you're having, you know, this is definitely one of the venues that can be used, you know, to promote this idea about psychological resilience in digital age. But I believe there should be more discussion about this. We're not discussing this enough.
Yeah, I agree. We're not discussing it enough. I really like that about protecting our cognitive space, because I don't think we really think about that. It's really protecting our headspace, our mental health. And also in terms of the data that we put out there, we don't think about that from a, this is by reducing the amount of data about ourselves we put out there, we're actually doing a lot to protect ourselves by keeping it off the internet.
Yes, how do we do that?
How do you do that exactly?
We are all dependent on the internet now. Well, I believe, you know, if you know, with kids, you know, I believe that some, anybody who is like 16 years old or younger shouldn't be even exposed to social media, anything like that. You know, they should be outside playing or whatever, you know, but being on the internet or social media, this is probably the worst thing. For parents, it's wonderful. You know, here's your phone, you know, do whatever you want. And they have kids 8, 9, 10 years old who are just constantly online. And this is actually terrible. It's terrible. And I think parents who are doing that, you know, they shouldn't be having kids. I think it's terrible. People are just not aware about all the problems arising from such behavior, because internet is such a terrible place, you know, if it's not being supervised, you know. So it's,
I think it's also that parents don't realize that there's a dark web and that there's a lot of people, and it's such a huge part of the internet and how vulnerable their children or they actually are.
Not only that they don't recognize, they're probably aware there is something, they heard that there is dark web, but they don't have the understanding of what it is. And also, people don't want to believe that their family could be a target of some sophisticated manipulation, because they think, why would I be interested? It's happening to somebody else. I read in the newspaper that it happened somewhere far away. But the thing is, when it strikes home, suddenly you are aware and you have completely different perspective of the situation. But that, at that time, it may be too late for that. And that's why it's important to have these discussions, that it happens. The same thing is with ransomware. I've been in so many different situations where companies, you know, when you talk to them about ransomware, they heard about it, they know it's happening to somebody else, but we are too small. Why would anybody attack us? And then it happens. And when it happens, the question is like, what should we do? How much is it going to cost? You know, how do we get our data back? But this is actually a reactive way of solving situation. And when you had a chance being proactive, you didn't do anything about it. So the same thing is with these psychological operations. You know, we need to talk about this worldwide, about the problem, because there are forces that actually want to do harm to our children, to ourselves. And we really need to be serious about this, you know, to understand the threat. And I'm not being paranoid here, but I really believe it's important to understand this threat and find ways actually how to educate people to recognize that there is something fishy going on the internet.
I think a lot of people also have the sense of, I'm a good person, it will never happen to me, or I only look at Facebook, or I only do this, it won't still won't happen to me. So it's, there's a kind of general sense, I think, of I don't do dodgy stuff. I don't go look porn, or I don't go into the dark web. So there's no way. And I'm, as you say, I'm kind of too small to be really someone who would be affected by it. So it's, yeah, it's, and then they get hits later on, and then they kind of go, oh, now I've got to try and figure out how to get out of it.
You know, so it's too late.
It's too late. Exactly. Yeah. Where do you think the future is going in terms of cybersecurity from a prevention and potential threat perspective? And you've spoken about needing to talk about it more and making it more awareness, but where do you think the future is?
It's always interesting to talk about future because every lecture I have for students, it's always ends about look at the future. You know? So where we're heading towards some asymmetric warfare. So basically small groups using AI to cause some disproportionate damage. But you also have the chance, you know, to build some intelligence defense systems and these systems that should adapt, you know, faster than attackers adapt. So the key will be here in the future. Well, now when we talk about future, I don't even know what the future is anymore. Is it next month? Is it 5 years from now, 10 years from now? Because everything is happening so fast with the technology. But the key will be governance and collaboration. And if you treat cybersecurity like an arms race, you know, we will lose. But if you treat it like a public health issue, you know, we share responsibility and with open dialogue, then we have actually a real shot at staying ahead of the situation.
That's a fascinating way of seeing it. It is about a public health issue, not an arms race. Because that makes it a lot more current right now. There's stuff going on rather than we've got to try and think about the future in 10 years' time.
Absolutely. No, because I do see this as a public health issue. Because once we have public health issue, then you have discussion and then we are trying to find solution. Otherwise, everything is an arms race. You know, we buy this, you buy that, you know, they're attackers, and then everything stays on a lower level of importance. If it's a public health issue, then suddenly, you know, it's being resolved. I'm not sure if you're there yet to treat it like that, you know, but I would recommend that we actually do it that way as a public health issue.
Yeah, and I agree with you, and I don't think we're there yet, but I think having it as that makes them a lot more proactive rather than the reactive side of you buy something, I'll counterbalance you and make sure you don't hit me with a nuclear bomb because I've got one too. Is there any particular favorite book that you normally recommend others to read in your kind of era of human factors and cybersecurity?
Well, there are actually a couple of books that I really like and appreciate. And actually a couple of authors that I personally met also, so it's a completely different level. One of the books is Democracy Hacked by a professor from King's College, London. I forgot the name, but Democracy Hacked, where he explained completely, and I actually listened to the presentation when he showcased his book. So I actually had to purchase the book, read the book, but it's actually about Cambridge Analytica and everything about Brexit, you know, so he completely investigated the whole situation. So this is where I actually got introduced to this psychological warfare, how it works. And it was like fascinating to me. And I believe that was like 2018, something like that, when I actually heard that. Really interesting book. And the second book is The Cyber Effect by Professor Mary Aiken. She is a cyber psychologist. I believe this is a must read because these books actually explores how human factor, you know, how it changes in digital space. And especially when it comes to manipulation, to online crime, identity. And this book really captures this intersection that we have discussed of psychology and technology. And there is one more book that I recently purchased, actually 2 weeks ago on the airport. I have it here in front of me. It's called Prisoners of Geography, this one. Really interesting. I bought it at the airport. And this book is about some... it's about geopolitics, basically. And also it's explaining in 10 different theaters, you know, how geopolitical strategy, how it continues to shape also the digital world from its structural vulnerabilities to cyber diplomacy. And it's basically explaining the history of each country, each continent, where we were in the past, where we are now, where we're heading to. So it's much easier to understand now all these trade wars that are happening, cyber warfare, kinetic warfare, so China, and also it's really good explanation. So these three books are actually something that I really enjoyed. I just finished reading the last one. Really, really, really interesting. But it all comes together. It's all about psychology, you know, about understanding the big picture.
Tom, thank you so much for joining me on Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. It was so fabulous to catch up with you, and I really look forward to chatting to you again in the future.